Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, crypto is back, baby. What's driving the price up? Where will it go next? Cashing out on your gains? Beware the CGT trap. Also, the number of ISA millionaires is up 228% in just 2 years. We have tips from Lord Lee on how you can become one too. Not Lord Lee Boyce. This is actually a real Lord. Also today, Labour's new pension mega fund. What is it and what will it mean for our retirement savings? Ways to get around inheritance tax when giving away your home. And Lee's Collecting Corner is back. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, crypto has been a bit quiet of late, out of the spotlight, just minding its own business. Then Trump gets voted back in and boom, Bitcoin surged beyond $89,000 for the first time. The rest of the crypto market has also seen a boost, with coins such as Cardano, Solana and Dogecoin also jumping on the back of the rises. So what is going on? Where is it likely to head next? And what do you need to be aware of if you are cashing out on your gains? Welcome to the pair of you.
Bitcoin specifically is having a melt-up. A melt-up is a, you know, kind of market phenomenon where the price just absolutely goes nuts. All of a sudden starts shooting up. Bitcoin is up 36% over the past month, and it is now up 102% this year. It's currently trading, as we record this podcast, at $89,000. I mean, by the time you listen to this podcast, it could be substantially different to that because the price is volatile. But on the 5th of November, it was trading at $68,000. So that's a pretty big move up. Now, what lies behind this? The triumph of the tech bros and Donald Trump. Donald Trump and his bromance with Elon Musk is the absolute key to the Bitcoin melt up. And also JD Vance, his deputy president-elect, vice president-elect, whatever you call them. Look, there is a scenario where this Trump presidency, Trump 2.0, as we talked about last week, is seen as major positive for the crypto industry. Why? And why is this happening? That's the big question. So Trump appears to have been convinced by, you know, the idea that crypto is a good thing. This is slightly different to Trump 1.0, where didn't seem that fussed about it, certainly wasn't massively in love with big tech and all that kind of thing. This time around, very interested in it, has said stuff on the campaign trail that is very has strong backing of it. JD Vance is a strong kind of crypto interest. Elon Musk, I mean, we don't really need to explain this anymore, but Musk loves crypto. Musk loves the idea of going to Mars. Musk loves building rockets, tunnels under cities, electric
himself.
Cars. Himself, you know, he's basically got that kind of Henry Ford meets Bond villain meets Iron Man vibe going on in his head. And now his new best friend is going to be the president of the United States of America. At the moment, it looks like everything's coming up Elon. I mean, Dogecoin, for example. Elon now has a department, which the acronym of is Doge. I mean, they're trolling us. The back end, more sensible bit of this, if you consider this more sensible, is that what we're probably going to see is a lighter touch on regulations on crypto in the US. Bitcoin had a big move up at the start of the year, off the back of the first Bitcoin ETFs being regulated by the SEC so they could then go on sale. Now, why that matters is because Bitcoin whilst very widely known, actually really quite widely held by people when you look at some of the polling and statistics. You know, there's lots of people who have a little bit of crypto that they've bought at some point, particularly if you look at certain demographics. You go below a certain age, there's lots of people who have a little bit, and that skews more towards men rather than women as well, kind of thing. I've got some Bitcoin. It's an insurance policy against Bitcoin going to the moon and all those other people being right and me being wrong. And I'm glad I've got it. But most of the financial world does not invest in Bitcoin. And most of the money that moves around the financial world is institutional money. If you create a regulated way of having some exposure to Bitcoin, it opens the door to all of those big financial institutions being able to have a bit of exposure to Bitcoin and being able to hold a bit of it because they hold it in an ETF. The ETF is regulated. That's totally fine with the rules that they have for their funds, the rules they have for their investors, and so on and so on. The more mainstream you make it, the easier it becomes for that to happen. And we're probably going to see more Bitcoin ETFs. We're going to see more institutional investors moving into it. That creates more demand for Bitcoin. Bitcoin, there is a finite amount of it eventually, and it gets harder to produce more with every year that passes. So it's very limited in supply. And if you substantially increase demand, then that drives the price up. That's the theory. But what's going on here is people are buying the theory. They're buying that I think the price will go up because of this situation. And it's very volatile. It's very, highly traded. You know, when Bitcoin has a melt up, it really does have a melt up. You know, that 36% in a month. You don't see that in a lot of stocks. You don't see it in a lot of markets. What the mistake that gets made sometimes is that people think, well, you know, all these financial institutions are hardly going to go big on Bitcoin. You know, it's super volatile. There's a reason why they don't go big on like really, really high risk small cap shares. They're super, super volatile, but they don't have to put that much of their money into it to, on aggregate, have a very large amount of demand compared to what there is when it's outside of the mainstream financial system. You know, if lots of funds just allocate 1% or 0.5%, that's still a big step up in demand. Now, that's Bitcoin. Bitcoin is seen as the main one, the main asset. It's the one that's seen, ironically, as like a store of value. Digital gold. Can you have a store of value that like swings around so wildly? I'm not so sure. But this is also potentially quite positive for some of the other mainstream cryptos, potentially Ethereum, for example, and then some of those other big ones, because you can't get the ETFs in those yet. And actually, what you might see is the ETFs in those, and then some of that institutional money move into those as well. Ethereum, for example, that's only up 19% this month. And 32% this year. So that's lagging quite a long way behind Bitcoin at the moment.
Right. Okay. Lee, Bitcoin, barge pole, touch.
I was just smiling there because I love the emphasis on only up
Yeah, I know.
32%. It depends on your viewpoint. If you're tempted to get involved now, it's a very different beast to getting involved at Bitcoin being at $5,000 a coin or $20,000 a coin. It's where your stomach lay, isn't it? It's where you think that this has got much more room to grow. One thing I would say is there's been some wild predictions out there, but not wild predictions from companies and people that are, you would, say a bit spivvy or a bit spurious.
Yeah.
I was reading something not that long ago suggesting $250,000 a coin next year, and that was from Standard Chartered, a report that they put out. You know, one of the world's biggest bank was saying, this was earlier in the year actually, saying that it was on course to reach $150,000 by the end of this year. I mean, at the time it seemed quite a mad thing to say, but now you're looking at it going, okay, there was something in that. And you know, perhaps they had predicted a Trump victory. Maybe they could see the future. Maybe they knew what was going on. But I, do you know, George, do you know why I know that crypto's back? Do you know why I know crypto's back? Other than the price rising.
Your hairdresser's talking about it?
Not quite that, but that will
Oh.
be the next thing. I am actually going to go and get my hair cut after this podcast, so I'll keep you
All right.
posted if that does happen.
Thanks.
So, spurious tube adverts. I've seen some very
Oh.
abstract adverts about crypto crop up at the end of this week around the tube network that I would say made absolutely no sense. And I kind of stared at this one poster It was like you can't spend pounds on the moon, and it was like oh no, on Mars, and it was like a Mars rover, and it was like, but how can I spend Bitcoin on Mars? I mean, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to test that theory out. But I think what a lot of people have done, and what Simon has said there, is that they've got involved in the last few years. That it's opened up way more mainstream. It is so much easier to get onto a platform that is offering a chance to buy in at cryptocurrencies, all different kind of cryptocurrencies. We're talking your Coinbases, your eToros, all of those kind of companies have made it very accessible to be able to get involved in this. And we were talking about it in the office. I remember when cryptocurrencies first sort of erupted, and I was kind of put in charge of writing the crypto content on This Is Money, trying to figure out what it all meant, getting down rabbit holes about blockchain and mining and all sorts of documents I was reading about different cryptos, etc. Back then, it was way more difficult to get involved. You were at the mercy of some really kind of like scary places to, and to then put your money somewhere where you didn't know what this place was, and then send your passport, all of that kind of stuff. It didn't feel like a very kind of, this hasn't got a central bank, this is all secret kind of vibe to it. It was like, you need my passport and my bank details. This all sounds a bit worrying. But it's become way more mainstream. Lots of people are hodling, holding on for dear life. I'm hodling all sorts of things in my financial. I mean, I'm you could argue I'm hodling premium bonds. I've been hodling premium bonds for I haven't won a prize, and I have enough money in it.
Oh, Lee.
But I think what people have kind of done, they've got into this with a very, very, very small percentage point of their portfolios. I'm talking probably less than 1%, most people. They've put in a few hundred quid, hoping that the prices will go up, probably a few hundred quid in a few of the less mainstream ones than Bitcoin, hoping that they'll just like go on the coattails of Bitcoin and then cash out at a certain point. So me personally, I've been waiting for Bitcoin to hit $100,000, because that was kind of my exit point. Well, because of where I entered, I thought if it ever gets to $100,000, I'll just sell out. And again, we had this conversation in the office this week. There are lots of people waiting for $100,000 and just all going to cash out. We were going to just like crash it at the same time. Is that what everyone's waiting for? I would say if you think about people that have got money in it, there's a small percentage of people that think this is the best thing since sliced bread and have put all of their assets in it. They've gone completely mad on crypto. Then you have some people that just think it's absolute nonsense. It's not worth the paper it's written on. It's all a massive bubble. It's all a scam. It's all a Ponzi scheme. It's all going to fall apart. And you've got most sensible people in between that going, well, it might be one or the other. But I tell you what, I've just put a little bit of money in so I don't miss out. And I think that's what a lot of people have done. I think I could speak for myself. I speak for Simon. We've just tiny amounts. It's not like we've put in thousands and thousands of pounds. It's just a small amount to make sure that you haven't missed the boat. And then something like this happens and crypto kicks off and it's gone mad. But you cannot rely on this to continuously go up and to put loads of money in it and expect it to. You have to treat it all with caution. And as with anything in life, if you're tempted to invest, you must go and read and understand what it is. Not completely, it's complex, but from a basic level, just to get an understanding.
I see Bitcoin less as an investment and more as like a Myers-Briggs or whatever it's called test as to your personality.
Do you mean Myers-Briggs?
Whatever, that one, ENTP Bitcoin, because I'm the sort of person that hates being pressured into anything. So it's like if I feel like I have FOMO or something, I'm just not interested. If people are going on about it's the next best thing, I'm not interested. That says a lot about my personality. So I'm not involved. If you want to get involved, your bag, as long as you understand the deals about it. Now, what some people may not think about is if you have done well and you've made some gains on it, our old friend, it's not an old friend, it's quite a new friend. We became very acquainted with capital gains tax recently ahead of the budget and during the budget. Do you have to pay CGT, Simon, on crypto gains?
Yes, you do. And the tax man is paying quite a lot of attention to this, owing to the fact that there are a sizable chunk of people who've made quite large gains on Bitcoin, and you can't hold Bitcoin in an ISA. So all of that is theoretically exposed to tax, combined with the fact that there are also a sizable number of people who've made those gains who think potentially one of two things. One, they have no idea that they're actually meant to be paying capital gains tax on it at all. A capital gains tax is not even like kind of registered on their radar, and they'd probably be quite surprised to find out that they have to pay some tax on the profit on this. And two, another chunk of people who know they have to pay capital gains tax on it, but think they could probably get away with not paying capital gains tax on it. If you combine those three ingredients, large gains on something that a sizable number of people hold, people who don't think they have to pay tax, people who think they can get away with not paying tax, it creates the perfect recipe for the tax man paying attention to something. We have had similar things to this in the past. So I remember when I first started out as a reporter, a financial reporter in the kind of mid-2000s, right? Buy-to-let was absolutely booming. Loads of people were getting into buy-to-let. It was like buy a city centre flat time, or go on a course that tells you how to buy a house up north using a credit card, because they were so cheap, and then remortgage it and then do it up and flip it and all that kind of stuff. Accidental landlords left, right, and centre. It's really easy to get mortgages, interest only mortgages, all that kind of stuff. People were making money. Everyone was telling people about how they were making money. There were so many people who thought that they could just do this without paying any tax. Like, there were so many people not paying tax on rental income. There were people not paying tax on the gains they were making on the properties because of quite often one of two things. One, they had no idea they were meant to be paying tax on it. Two, those who did know they were meant to be paying tax on it, quite a few of them thought, well, how are they ever going to know? And the tax man cracked down on it. So the tax man does know. And actually, the tax man knows more now than the tax man knew 20 years ago, because there's a lot of reporting that goes on to the tax man from investment platforms, from your bank. We've talked about this with savings interest. How do they know about my savings interest? Well, your bank reports it to them. So HMRC, that's how they know. And you might think, oh, they'll never find me. But, if they're doing a trawling exercise on something in particular, like Bitcoin, they might find you. Now, there is the question, obviously, and I could see why people might be thinking this, if they hold crypto in a kind of, the original way, in one of these, crypto wallet type things. You don't remember the story of the man who still maintains that his computer's somewhere in a dump somewhere and is offered to pay to dig the dump out and stuff like that. If you hold your Bitcoin like that, there's got to be people sitting there thinking, well, they're never going to know. And I suppose if you just like cashed it in and then kept it within the system and never took it out, then maybe they wouldn't. But like, if you suddenly lump a load of money in your bank account, ding, 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 that can set off an alarm bell. So yeah, you are meant to pay capital gains tax on it. And unfortunately, owing to the previous Chancellor's wisdom, a certain Mr. Jeremy Hunt, who for some absolute mystifying reason had it in for small investors, and not just crypto investors, he seemed to have it in for all small investors. He decided to lower the capital gains tax free allowance from £12,300 to just £3,000. He also slashed the dividend allowance as well. To compound the misery, our new Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, she of the Miserabilism School of Economic Management, which has come through wonderfully in some peachy GDP figures today, decided to raise the capital gains tax rate. So there's a double whammy there. So you're going to be paying a higher capital gains tax rate. You're going to be paying either 20% or 24% now, and it's on any gains that you make over £3,000 a year. And if you try and evade tax, you quite possibly will get caught. And then you quite possibly will get in trouble, and you quite possibly will be fined. So if you are going to sell your crypto or your Bitcoin, unfortunately, cold hard reality of it is you're going to have to pay some tax. But there are ways to reduce the tax. £3,000 allowance every year. Okay. So use your £3,000 allowance. You can sell over 2 tax years. So for example, you could cash in some gains now, some gains after April. One of the ones that usually gets talked about is passing assets to your spouse, because that's tax-free. You can do that without triggering a capital gains tax liability. It's harder with crypto. I'm not sure how you go about this. I thought we should do an ask an expert question on this, because I wonder whether you can actually do it. Losses. If you've made a loss on something, you can basically put your loss against your gain. So, in the same tax year, say you made a £600 loss on Cardano, but you'd made a £4,000 gain on Bitcoin, you can set that £600 to get you £4,000, and it lowers your capital gains tax bill. I mean, I think the big question for people, though, and I think actually for a lot of people who do hold crypto or who've held Bitcoin for a long time, is whether they want to cash in those gains or not. I'll tell you about a bullet that I dodged here. I have a small amount of Bitcoin, right? I don't have anywhere near a whole Bitcoin. I wish I had a whole Bitcoin. Wish I'd done. That boat sailed long before I had a chance to jump on. Well, actually, sorry, it didn't sail long before I had a chance to jump on it. I didn't jump on that boat when that boat was sailing around me in circles for many years. And then the ship sailed off into the distance. But like, so it's net off, thanks to like all these gains, we're talking like high four figures kind of thing. So it's more than a £3,000 gain that I've got on it. I've had it since 2018, right? I nearly sold enough to like trigger a three to like use the allowance, the £3,000 allowance before the budget, before they were going to put the capital gains tax rates up. So I thought, well, I should probably do that. And actually, I've always got this troubling thing in my head of like, how long am I going to keep holding on to this thing for? You know, at what point do I just go, yeah, okay, you've had the best of it. Maybe take some money out and move on. And I'd quite like to take the money out and actually do something with it. So I'd quite like to. I've actually like I need to sort out the bodywork on my classic car, right? And that's really expensive, doing like resprays and bodywork. So I've always thought, well, actually that'd be quite a good thing. It's like take that money out and use it to do that because I don't have the money to do it otherwise. But I didn't get round to selling any of it before the budget. I basically just didn't have time. Obviously, the budget made us all quite busy ahead of time, and then we've had this big melt up afterwards. And I look at it and I'm like, glad I didn't sell, because the amount of money that I would have saved myself in the tax, I would have then lost out on. So that's, you know, inertia helped me there. But now I look at it and I go, well, I mean, should I sell it now? I mean, as Lee said, we had a conversation the other day of like, is it going to hit 100,000, then absolutely plummet when everybody goes, right, hit the target, I'm selling. And it is that kind of big question of how long do you keep holding on to this stuff for? And it's really difficult with stuff that's quite volatile or has gone up a lot. But before we finish talking about Bitcoin, just to say, whilst we talk about this as being, you know, a real gamble, a real punt, the volatility highlights everything. Nvidia, world's largest company, or was the other week. Nvidia shares, guess how much they're up this year?
It's a lot. I was going to say, you
205%.
told us that as your start of the week.
And they're up 205% this year. So you think Bitcoin's up a lot. Bitcoin's only doubled. Nvidia's up 205%. And over 5 years, Nvidia shares are up 2,777%. So if you'd got
Wow.
in on that, if you'd have jumped on that ship when it was sailing around you in circles, you'd be a very, very happy person.
Yeah, you would. All right, then let's leave crypto to one side, shall we? And we'll go, Lee, to the staple, perhaps, of investors a little bit more. ISAs. The number of ISA millionaires, talking about soaring figures, has shot up in recent years. The most recent data, though, that we have from HMRC is from 2022, and it shows there were 4,850 people who had pots worth a cool million or more. Now, just 2 years before that, in 2020, there were 1,480. So the number of ISA millionaires jumped by 228%. And let's be honest, it's likely to have gone up, Lee Boyce, I imagine, quite a bit since that time. So what is the trick to being an ISA millionaire? Firstly, how high are some of these pots that we've HMRC figures?
So high that I looked at this a good 5 to 10 times and kept on scratching my head and saying, sorry, people have got how much in an
How is
ISA?
it possible?
How have they done that? So, as you rightly said there, 4,850 people ISA millionaires. The data's from 2 years ago. I reckon I'm going to stick my neck out here and say that figure could have doubled since, just given the amount of time, £20,000 annual allowance, all that kind of stuff. I reckon it could be close. It was a Freedom of Information request from Money App Plum to HMRC. And as you were to say, 228% since 2020, just between those 2 years. I mean, that's an incredible number. But and actually, the average ISA millionaire has a pot worth 1.35 million, the data revealed. Now, the bit that really, really made me go, you what? 25 of the most dedicated ISA savers have managed to rack up pots, averaging £8.9 million. Now you can see why I was going no,
What?
and I went full Professor Frink on this. Sorry if you don't watch The Simpsons, and I was like trying to sort of like get a computer. So I was like trying to get the calculator to work. I was like, "Wow, what's how have the people done over time? Ah, this can't be right." But actually, when you think about it, if you've done really well, and we've got some tips coming that I'll tell you about in a sec, if you've done well, it is feasible that this could have happened to you. Now, you would have had to have some fantastic investing. I was going to
Yeah,
say
because I've
luck.
only been around for 25 years.
Well, they have and they haven't, because ISAs have been around for 25 years. So they launched in 19, but before that, you had PEPs, which were personal equity plans. They were launched in 1987, which the year I was born. I feel like that's really fitting for some reason. By then Chancellor Nigel Lawson, and they had an annual allowance of £2,400. Crucially, PEPs were allowed to be rolled into the new ISA wrappers. So I was actually I when I was again in the office the other day talking about this, I was like, 1987, how long ago was that? I was like, it's the year you're born. How old are you? And I was like, how old am I? And I'm 30. You get to a point in your life, don't you? You just forget how old you are. Like 37 years. So the best way to sort of illustrate this and tell you a bit about it a bit more. Lord John Lee of Trafford. Now you might have heard of this man before. He crops up quite a lot in the kind of personal finance pages of newspapers, etc. The reason why is because he became the first ISA millionaire in 2003. He reached £1 million on contributions of £126,200 over 16 years, and his annualized returns during that period were 21%. He's an expert stockbroker, he's an ex-MP. He's also a good friend of This Is Money and the podcast. He's very willing to chat, and he's very open about kind of how he's done this. So if you think about it, he became an ISA millionaire in 2003. We're 21 years sailed into the future since then. So you can only imagine if you start annualizing his return, if he's still making the same kind of returns, maybe he's even made better returns in that since, who knows? But we did chat to him. So Helen Curran, our savings reporter, tracked him down, had a couple of conversations with him, tried to get his kind of magic formula into doing it. Now we did ask him if he was one of these 25 in the £8.9 million zone, and he didn't want to commit. He didn't want to tell us, which I think is absolutely fair enough. You know, it's kind of like he really has become the face of ISA millionaires, and I didn't expect him to tell us, if I'm being quite frank with you. But he was very open about kind of how he's done it, and you know, he basically told Helen that his ISA's value is now well north of that first million and has grown very significantly. So make of that what you will, and how much that would be. So if we go back in time just for ISAs, you got to remember that there was an annual allowance for quite a long time of £7,000 from sort of 1999 when it launched all the way up to 2007, 2008. And that didn't really go anywhere. And then we start to get some significant jumps, mainly driven by a certain Mr. George Osborne, who was very much a big fan of ISAs. And then in 2009-10, we had a big bump to £10,200. 2015-16 was when the real fun started to begin, £15,240. And it started to become a point where you had a choice of mixing your cash ISAs and your stocks and shares ISAs and having a bit more control of what you're doing. Then 2017, £20,000 annual allowance. Now we've actually just found out in the budget that £20,000 allowance, it looks likely to be frozen all the way to 2030. So we're going to have 13 years essentially of a £20,000 annual ISA limit. Now it's worth pointing out these ISA millionaires, they're all being stocks and shares, they're all be investing. You're not going to be getting these kind of returns on a cash ISA. You know, this is investing. Now what Lord Lee said to us, he's kind of got three tips here. Some of it, you might go, sweet, yeah, of course that's that. But number one, of course, is to max out your ISA allowance. The only way you could really become an ISA millionaire is to max out it every year. There's varying stats out there suggesting that close to one in five ISA savers max it out. There's other figures that suggest it's more 4 or 5%. Maybe the true figure in that is somewhere in between. But you cannot do this without maxing it out. And most people, I would suggest, that have become ISA millionaires probably had PEPs before this as well. So they've had a head start. They had a 12-year head start. Reinvesting dividends. So essentially, he has done this just by reinvesting dividends, is what he's kind of said to us here. It compounds what you're doing. So you reinvest the cash, you pay that as a dividend to buy extra shares in the company, rather than receiving it as cash, and you rinse and repeat. And that's a jewel in the crown of many investors' kind of portfolios, is to reinvest dividends. And he's a big fan of it. The last one is, he said here, be lucky in your investments. Now, I don't think you can, of course, you can be lucky as an investor, but I would have thought someone like Lord Lee would do his homework, and he's not making spurious punts on Bitcoin blindly hoping that it's just going to go up. Well, of course, it's not, because you can't put it in an ISA wrapper. But you know what? He would have been doing his due diligence. He would have been looking at companies to find to invest in. And the one he points out here is Carillion. Is an example he gave to us. It's a telecoms company. It listed in 2016. He's saying here, share price in March 2016, first day of dealing, was 98p, and it's risen to 1,932p since. And he says he's been at the on the receiving end of 60 takeover bids for companies he holds, which has given his investments a boost. So this is some experienced stock picking. This is some experienced investing, but done crucially in a tax-free wrapper. Because if that wasn't in a tax-free wrapper, you would be sitting on some pretty sizable tax bills, I'd imagine.
Well explained. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Invest and Explain feature. Welcome to the podcast. The dust has settled on the budget. What have people been contacting you about most in the aftermath?
Hi Lee, I've had lots and lots of calls about changes to pensions with respect to inheritance tax. And what's really happened is that once again, we're being reminded that pensions were designed to provide income when we stop working. But some people had been using them as an inheritance tax vehicle, and that's no longer possible, or it won't be possible from April 2027. What I say to people is, in the budget, what changed immediately. But with regard to the pension changes, they don't come in until April 2027. So you've got time to plan and adjust. It encourages you to spend the money saved in your pension, and also encourages you to give money away. If you're worried about inheritance tax, those are the two things that are really the best thing to do: to enjoy life, spend your income, and also to give away when you can afford to as well.
So it's a general message, just don't panic.
Don't panic, absolutely. We've got time, we've got until 2027. In fact, a lot of the detail, the technical detail, is subject to a consultation that won't report for some time as well. So we don't know a lot of things.
Lisa, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Lee.
Welcome back. Fresh from her budget speech, the Chancellor has announced another big change for our cash. The government plans to use our pension savings to boost economic growth by creating pension mega funds. And apparently, the majority of us are on board with the idea. Although, while this is Money Readers, there's a poll we'll find out a little bit later. But firstly, Simon, break it down for us. Pension mega fund. It sounds very cool. How will it work? What's the point of this? Who will it affect? What are the benefits?
Yes. Pension mega funds. Sounds mega, doesn't it? Right. So, local government pension schemes. Not the world's most exciting things in the world. 86 separate ones, though. And they are all responsible for providing a defined benefit pension for people who work for those respective councils and local authorities. That's quite a job to do, to be honest, creating, you know, sustainable defined benefit pension schemes, investing the money and, you know, deciding where to do it. And unfortunately, a series of events over the last 30 years have conspired to really kick the rungs out from underneath defined benefit pensions. Now, firstly, you can trace this back to a Conservative government and the decision to allow the defined benefit pension schemes that were in massive surplus to repurpose some of that money. They were in massive surplus because the stock market did really, really well in the 80s. Things then shifted around, and unfortunately, they then stopped being in surplus and they had been allowed to do other stuff with the money that they could have then relied on in years to come. Gordon Brown changed some rules around dividends, kicked another rung out from underneath them. Then you had the 2000s and the financial crisis and interest rates being cut down to the bone, and that booted another rung out from underneath them. And the whole thing that's happened along this time is that they have veered more away from the stock market and more towards investing in bonds, which is why very, very low interest rates impacted them, because gilt yields absolutely plummeted. And this was actually a sort of deciding factor in the biggest shakeup that we've seen of the pension landscape, because annuity rates also plummeted, and that led to pension freedom. The problem we have now is we have lots and lots of money, £80 billion, it's estimated, being invested in a very, very arguably kind of sensible way. Although the thing that it's largely being invested in is meant to be a safe investment, but government bonds, I mean, they're not really the safest investment, because over the past kind of 10 to 15 years, they've veered between situations of paying almost no return whatsoever, seeing their prices move around wildly. And now all of a sudden they are paying good returns, but lots of pension funds hold the old, not so good ones that aren't paying good returns. And at the same time, we're not seeing much money going into the stock market, in the UK stock market, that has shrunk substantially. We're not seeing any of the money going into infrastructure. We're not seeing it going into, you know, backing things that could really help growth in this country. Instead, it's just going into, you know, buying government debt, which actually arguably we do need people to buy our government debt. So at least it's doing that. The idea is that if we try to encourage these schemes to merge together for their investment management and pool their assets, then they can start trying to invest in stuff that delivers a bit more growth to the country. So, for example, according to the Treasury, Canada's pension schemes invest around four times more in infrastructure, while Australian pension schemes invest around three times more in infrastructure and 10 times more in private equity, such as businesses, compared to defined contribution schemes in the UK. So the other idea behind this is also to try to pull together multi-employer defined contribution pension schemes. Don't fall asleep here, okay? This is basically large pension funds, not defined benefit ones, final salary, career average type ones, but ones where they build up an investment pot, but there's large kind of big trust, master trust schemes, pull all this stuff together and they invest lots of money rather than it being one for an so each individual company having their own defined pension contribution system, they join up to these big ones. But if they can put some of these ones together and get some of this money going into the UK stock market and backing UK assets, the idea is that this could be good for the UK, good for growth, and good for pension funds as well, because they'll start making better returns rather than having to attach themselves to very, very low return assets, like, you know, gilts, for example.
And what, Simon, could possibly go wrong with this? What are some of the concerns?
Oh, so some of the concerns surround some of the stuff that actually the Tories tried to do as well, where they're trying to increase investment into private business, privately listed businesses. So not publicly listed businesses, private businesses that aren't listed on the stock exchange, and into more kind of scale up startup businesses, which is, you know, a good thing. And they need access to capital. They are high risk, though. You know, this kind of venture capital investing is a very, very high risk scenario, as is, you know, private equity. The returns can be great, but it's a portfolio approach and you need to have, you know, lots of different companies. Now, pension schemes, your local government pension scheme, or your defined contribution kind of pension scheme of a company, is not really in a position to be making those kind of investment management decisions. So they're going to have to get professionals in to do it for them. Now, the other thing about venture capital, private equity investing, is the fees are high. And one of the things that you can control in investing is fees. And broadly speaking, the lower you can get your fees down to, and the more simple you can make your investing, the better the returns over the years. The problem is that the best way to get your fees down and to make your investing simple is to buy a global tracker fund with a really, really low ongoing charges figure. But then what you're doing is you're putting 70% of your investments into the US stock market. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So, you know, arguably, I think you need to take some of the claims around how much this will boost returns with a pinch of salt. You need to watch out for how much is this going to cost investors? Is this going to like end up being, you know, a lot more on their pension? But also you have to look at this and go, look, this is a good thing. We do need to be doing this. We do need to be encouraging pension funds to back Britain a bit more. And when we say back Britain, we don't need them buying BP and Shell shares or Rolls-Royce shares or BAE shares. We don't need them buying the shares of those massive, you know, multinational companies. We need them supporting the UK bit of the stock market, the mid caps down to the small caps kind of thing. But the companies that are getting bought out by foreign takeovers. And we had another foreign takeover this week, which ironically this time round involved taking over a stock exchange. Aqui, which is like the kind of smaller stock exchange, is being taken over by a Swiss company, Six. It's great for Aquis, I can't remember how you pronounce it, shareholders. They're paying like 100% premium on the share price or something. But that says to you that that company is woefully undervalued on the UK stock exchange. It's a really good company. It's quite exciting what they've been doing. They've really been trying to do some interesting stuff. And an outside investor from another country has gone, I'll have that. And I think it's so underpriced, I'll pay twice what you could buy it for right now on the stock exchange. That is the scenario that we need to change. And that is why we just relentlessly talk about the UK market being undervalued. It's because nobody really wants to buy it that much. So if you can try to change things around at the institutional level, potentially that's good news for everyone.
Lee, on your site, you've got a little poll there. What do your readers think of all this?
Oh, it's not a little poll, Georgie. 2,246 votes. Poll. This is a big poll. So the poll question was, do you want your pension invested to drive economic growth? 67% of the vote said no, focus purely on getting me the best returns. So people, you know, obviously with their retirement pots just want to see good returns, you know, more so than where the money's invested. But the second highest answer is yes, if it doesn't lower my returns. Probably gives you more of a snapshot of what people want. And I love it that 1%, not sure, but let's try it. And there was 6% saying, yes, I'm wholly in favour. So it's quite clear what our readers think. Basically, do not do anything that's going to make me have a poorer retirement.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of the unknown, isn't it? And I think Simon kind of sold the idea there quite well, if I'm being honest.
I just think it's when the government and pensions just makes people probably a bit nervous.
Makes me itchy. I know where you're
going. All right, then, reader question time. So bear with me on this one. This is about inheritance tax. My total estate, reader here, will be worth approximately £700,000 by the time that I die. I would like to transfer ownership of my 3-bedroom house, which is currently worth approximately £550,000, to my nephew and nieces in equal proportions to benefit from the 7-year rule and avoid inheritance tax. I would pay market rent to them so that the transfer doesn't count as a gift without reservation. I would need, however, to rent out 3 rooms and live in 1 room myself in order to afford the rent. Would this mean that I'm still benefiting from the house in such that it would be a gift with reservation? Also, if I sublet the rooms, could I still benefit from rent-a-room tax relief on the income, even though I would be a tenant myself? Lots to unpick here, Lee. Where do we start with this? I think, first of all, the inheritance tax allowances, you do get that £175,000 additional residential. But I imagine from reading this, your reader doesn't have kids, so that wouldn't apply. Is that right?
This is like one of those questions where you're like, wow, this is the sort of kind of complex level of financial planning that people are taking. And I always fundamentally think that transferring ownership of homes typically isn't the smartest move. Now, that's not a kind of fits everyone kind of comment. And I think in a case like this with so much money involved that you should always take financial advice, even if you just pay for one-off financial advice here to find out the consequences. Now, taking it from this question, I agree with you. It doesn't sound like they have children. You know, potentially if they do have children, perhaps they don't talk to the children. We don't know all of the ins and outs of it, but to transfer it over to nephew and nieces would suggest as such. It's then to then live in the house and rent out a room in the house, I think is quite a big step. That's quite, I mean, obviously there would have been thought put into this, and I would say at the moment, especially after the budget, there has been so much interest around inheritance tax and pensions, inheritance tax and total estate. You know, people are incredibly interested in all this. But, you know, inheritance tax is complex. It requires lots of careful long-term planning. There's a few things that this reader should consider. And actually, I'm gonna parrot some of the response here from one of the experts, Andrew Smith, who's an IFA at Flying Colours. He said, firstly, is it necessary? So what he means by that is, do you have sufficient allowances to mean that if you died today, there'd be no IHT liability? So most people don't pay IHT on assets up to £325,000. And if you have a spouse, you can pass assets free from IHT, and then IHT is calculated on second death. So if this person's widowed, they might have inherited partner's IHT allowance, which would take you up to £650,000. Again, we don't know that from the question. There's no mention here of a wife, an ex-wife, any kind of spouse. So we can only go on the assumption that I don't even know if it's he or she, that this person hasn't. And you know, but if they did, it would reduce the liability to around £20,000, and it could be reduced further by depleting assets above this limit. You know, by using annual allowance of £3,000 each year to gift to others, for example, plus small unlimited gifts of up to £250, and probably the most important thing of all, spending it on yourself, spending it for the here and now, enjoying yourself. And he says that, you know, it's not the case here, but it should be noted that if you were to pass your property directly to children or grandchildren, you could also benefit from the resident nil band of £125,000 each, which could potentially take the total allowance up to £1 million, which he then says this course of action would then be completely unnecessary. Also, gift with reservations. So for you to benefit from a reduction of your IHT liability by gifting here to nieces and nephews, you have to be careful that the tax man doesn't see it as a gift with reservation. And this is where you give something away but continue to benefit from it, and it will still be considered part of your estate upon death and taxed as such. So to avoid this, he says there's three things you've got to do. Your niece and nephew, so who would become the landlords, must charge a commercial rent that reflects the market value. And in the question, the person's rightly saying this. So they're not trying to kind of rent this on the cheap or kind of budget in that way. Then ensure that the arrangement is documented properly with formal rental agreements. So you've got a paper trail, basically you're doing this officially. And then consider having the rental payments reflected in your financial records. You have to survive 7 years for this to be fully free of IHT. And then there's a point here about the rental room relief. So this scheme allows individuals to earn up to £7,500 per year tax-free from renting it out, renting out furnished accommodation in a home. But in this case, you wouldn't be the owner any longer. Instead of renting a room for your nephew and nieces, you know, you'd be renting for your nephew and nieces to be the landlords, and you just wouldn't be eligible for this relief. So it's a hard one to unpick, but I think what I would take away from it is that there's been a lot of panic about inheritance tax and what it means for the future. And rightly so, people, I think, have put financial planning right back on their agenda again. And I think sometimes we do fall down as a country in terms of preparing for, you know, the inevitable because it's morbid and we don't want to really think about it too much. But there are a lot of people that I feel are considering things like this when they might not necessarily really need to be considering it. And potentially the IHT bill wouldn't be as big as what they anticipate. And that's why I think it's really important to take one-off financial advice at the very minimal in a case like this, when it involves a home or an estate. You know, £700,000 estate is big enough in my mind to sit down with a financial advisor for a few hours and sound them out about this. That's what I would say. And I always think that signing over a house to anyone, I think should be, on the whole, the very, very last option.
It makes me really nervous because I think, what if you can't sublet those rooms? You would be on the hook, wouldn't you, to have to cover that?
You'd have to have a plan, wouldn't you? You'd have to have someone in mind that's going to come and sublet these rooms. But
this is three people you'd need.
And I don't know, you know, I don't know the age of this reader. So, you know, you think renting typically is young, not always, but on the whole is younger people. You know, you'd have to find people basically willing. Again, we don't know the location either. If we knew the location and age, maybe we'd have a few more answers on this, because, you know, if it was London, the southeast, I mean, you're always going to find people to rent rooms on the whole, but it could be a tough sell. So you're right. You know, are you on the hook if you don't get these sublet? Are you then making your niece and nephew suffer financially because they can't, you know, keep going with the upkeep? I don't know. It's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure to put on yourself in order to kind of dodge some tax in the future. And I say some tax in many cases.
Also, that's gonna be huge. If HMRC do decide it's a gift with reservation, then the estate will just go back into inheritance tax. And the whole point of you living then, which I can't even imagine at any age now, beyond 35, of living with three separate people in your home in your latter years, is all for naught, because it will just go straight back into inheritance tax. So yeah,
that's the risk, isn't it? That's the risk,
right?
And is it worth the risk? That's what.
Make sure that whatever decision you do, you know, cross the T's, dot the I's, make sure it's all legit. Anyway, Lee, onto a slightly lighter subject from death and inheritance tax. Collecting Corner is back. You've been to a trading card show. Paddington Bear is not just at the cinema. It's also being traded and sold, and old bears and all sorts. Lee.
Yeah, so I went to... I need a little jingle for this, Georgia. I hope you've got a jingle in my Lee's Collecting Corner.
Next week, mate, next week.
Okay, all right, got you. Yeah, it's a work in progress. I was at a trading show last weekend, and I was in a personal capacity, and I wasn't actually planning on writing or even telling you about this because... I don't know, it feels a little bit kind of embarrassing going to a trade card show, like a card show.
Own it, Lee. It's fine.
I'm gonna own it. I've owned it. I've written the newsletter. Yeah,
exactly.
So last Saturday, I went to the Brentwood Centre, and inside there lay many, many, many stallholders from across the country who were selling trading cards. Now, I was there with my nephew and brother-in-law, who I've mentioned this podcast a couple of times because they've got into Pokemon cards, and they invited me along just to go and see what it was like. And I'll be honest, Georgie, I came away and I was absolutely kind of... the size of it, the popularity in the mixed crowd really, really just hit home. Until you live and breathe it, you don't realise how big something's got. And trading cards have got massive. Now, I'll go back to something you said earlier in the show. When I was at school, Pokemon really kicked off. Late 90s, I was right the correct age for it. But I was exactly like you said earlier, because everyone was into it, I wasn't into it. I was one of those kind of kids. I was like, I did not get into the fads. Don't know what this is. This is just some cards with some like cartoons on it. Like, what can I possibly do with these? Like, you know, just wasn't into it whatsoever. But I understand, you know, if that's your jam, that's your jam. So anyway, I went along at some of the things, and I'll tell you a couple of stories. First of all, I was standing next to a lady who was haggling on a Disney, they're called Weiss Schwartz Disney trading cards. And what these cards typically are, they're graded. Right. If you've got a rare card, you'd go and pay a grading service to give it a kind of rating out of 10. And a PSA 10 is like the top rating. And then you get it all kind of like sealed up and make sure it doesn't get any damage, all that kind of stuff. So she was trying to buy this PSA 10 Steamboat Willie card. And she was like, I've been after this card for months, blah, 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 blah. Would you take £2,600 for it? And my ears pricked up. I was like, wow. And this card, I think, was up for about $3,500. Mad stuff. I saw boxes of booster cards, wow, locked away in cabinets, $15,000. You know, it's half a house deposit, if not more. It's just blown up. And a bit like Bitcoin, I guess.
Yeah.
In a bit of a bubble moment, I don't know. Is it a lot of nostalgia driving adults and then passing it on to their children, seeing it as a kind of investment? I think that's what a lot of this is being driven by, thinking that you could buy, you know, a rare card and you and your children can enjoy it. Like my nephew and brother-in-law, they've got a cabinet full of all of this stuff and it looks great. And they enjoy doing it together, you know. And I guess if the whole market collapses and all the prices fall, we at least are stuck with some cars that you like the look of. But it's all come around so much more, so much again. You know, late sealed 1990s, late 90s and early 2000 cards go for a huge amount of money. And you only have to go on social media, YouTube and the like, and you can be bombarded by pool videos. Now, that sounds dodgy, granted, a pool video. But what a pool video is that you buy a pack of trading cards and you open it up live or streaming it and hoping for a rare card, basically. And you could buy a £5 pack of Pokemon cards and you could end up with a card in there worth £100 or £200. And then a sort of holy grail kind of card. So it's kind of exciting, you know, in a way. As listeners will know, it's not my thing. I'm more into the retro video game collecting, which in itself is sad enough, but you know, I enjoy it, so it's fine. But I did come away with a couple of buys, Georgie, and I'm going to show you. I came back, I really just want to see this, but I've got Ian Wright 1993
classic
card here.
Nice.
Now, the reason
why
I bought this is because I went to Highbury for the first time in 93 with my brother.
Nice.
I saw him score in the goal in front of me. I got it home, actually. I paid £1 for this, and I thought that was quite a nice price. It's something I hold on to. They actually sell on eBay for about £20.
There you go, Lee.
There's only 5,000 made, so I thought that was quite cool. I bought this one in honor of Mr. Simon Lambert, which is a
Pikachu,
surfing Pikachu. Seeing that Simon's quite into surfing, I saw it for a couple of quid and I thought, I thought it looks quite fun. And lastly, I'm quite into my basketball, and if you listen to it again, you might know I bought this card, right? This is Dirk Nowitzki, who was one of the most famous European players to ever play in the NBA, if not the greatest European player to play in the NBA until recently, with the influx of players like Jokic and stuff. But it's got a piece of his game-worn shirt in there. Can you see that?
Oh, nice. Yeah, just about, yeah.
From his last season, playing in the NBA, played for the Mavs for a very, very long time. And I just thought it was cool. You know, I paid £10 for that. Is it worth £10? Well, I don't know. Would it grow in value? Well, I don't know. But for the price of...
Do you like it?
A pint and a half in London. I've got it. It looks good. It's fun. I didn't mind. And I just did a few purchases like that. And then lastly, in the little collecting corner, we have our bi-weekly column from Dan Hatfield, who's a TV. He's on This Morning and a few other bits and pieces. And he values readers... kind of collectibles. Now, the collectible stuff that we're looking for in this, the series is called Modern Treasures. So we're looking for kind of, you know, those nostalgic 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s type kind of items. And this column, I think, is going from strength to strength. I think it's become very popular and lots of people kind of enjoy reading it. Dan has this real kind of great style of being able to weave in a bit of history and a bit of like kind of fun. It's a good sort of like Friday read, kind of seeing if people have got items that are worth money. We've got a Paddington double header here. So we've got an original, one of the original bears here that someone sent in. It's from 1974, so it's 50 years old. There's a toggle missing, but otherwise the reader says Paddington's in fine fettle. And actually, when I talk about the history and all that kind of thing, it goes back to Jeremy Clarkson. His mum had the kind of license to make the original Paddington bears. So in 1972, Shirley Clarkson, not in darkest Peru, but deepest Doncaster, created a Paddington bear for her children at Christmas, one of whom was Jeremy. And then they liked it so much that they managed to get an official license to produce them. And then they had that for a few years, and then it got taken over by another company. But this bear specifically, it was 1974, so we know it was one of the Clarkson made ones, and it was called Gabriel Designs. So this reader saying, had this in my family for a very long time. Lots of, like, you know, children, grandchildren have played with it. Should I be tucking it away? But actually, the value of this, I thought it would be a little bit more than this, but it, actually 20 to 30 quid. If it had the original label and the toggle, it could have been worth 50 to 60 quid. You know, it's all about condition, as it is with a lot of these things. So the reader in question is probably best just to hold on to it and enjoy it, and the grandkids enjoy it. The last one is a Paddington print that someone found in a charity shop for £30. Realised that it was signed by the author Michael Bond. It was one of 495 that were made, and it's a print of Peggy Fortnum, who was the original illustrator of Paddington. This reader says, I've went away, found some online for £600. Another US website had one for $800. Could it be worth more, like a grand, now that Paddington's even more popular than ever before? And Dan went and tracked down, did some sort of digging on this one, and sometimes this stuff can be quite subjective. It's very hard to put a value on something like this. So he gives a price point of this of between £200 to £300, which I tell you what, is not a bad return on a 30 quid charity shop find. So we love these kind of stories.
Yeah.
As I say, it's become a very popular kind of series. It's always an interesting read. So if you do have some modern treasures laying around your home in your loft, I'm talking about, I really want to do a special on vinyl, for example. If you've got a vinyl collection, Pokemon cards, trading cards. We haven't done a trading card special. More than willing to look at something that you think has got rare. Let's become rare. If you think about those kind of 70s, 80s, 90s things that you might have laying around and you want a price on it, editor@thisismoney.co.uk, modern treasures in the subject line.
I've got some sports memorabilia. So if you see an article coming up in a few weeks...
Oh, we'd love to do sports memorabilia. Sports,
probably me.
We haven't done. If you've got something that you would like to get value, Georgie, please do send it in and then we can talk about it on the podcast.
I have to send it in the normal way. Don't I get like fast-tracked?
Mate, I'd be getting you to email me wherever you'd email me to look at it, wouldn't I? How else would I... How would I fast-track you? I'd fast-track you by you emailing me a picture of it in the...
WhatsApp. All right, mate, what do you think of this?
You can WhatsApp it to me. Yeah, that's
okay. Back in the queue.
You can WhatsApp me the picture and your story.
Awesome. All right, Simon, waiting patiently there. Thank you so much. It is time for your stat of the week. This is going to be the longest podcast in the world.
Right, stat of the week. How long is the longest podcast in the world? Well, it'd be Joe Rogan, wouldn't it? Oh, my God. Right. I mean, like, wow.
We've got time. We've got, like, loads of time to go
We've
then.
We've got until Tuesday. there was a report out this week. Scottish widows looked at median retirement income and the difference between men and women. The median retirement income for men in this country, after tax and after housing expenses, £17,000. The median retirement income for women, £12,000, considerably lower. And that means that women are not on track, or median women, are not on track to hit the minimum standard of living in retirement figure for the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association, which is £14,400. Men are. But the good news is that actually this could theoretically get better thanks to auto-enrolment. And actually buried in this, and this stat has a point, is something I think is quite a good idea from Scottish widows, which is the idea of being couples being able to have combined pension pots to collectively accumulate retirement savings in a family pension plan. And actually, if you think about how pensions are often treated for a married couple, for example, in the example of divorce or something, that would actually make perfect sense.
All right, thank you very much for that, Simon. You also have some updates for us, don't you? Because we've got two messages. If you didn't listen to last week's show, even if you do, you've probably forgotten it already. Tell us, Simon.
Yeah, so congratulations if you got this far.
Yep.
Well done. Right, we have got two things. So firstly, it's the 10th anniversary of the This Is Money podcast. That was last week. Listen back if you want to find out more. We are doing a special little birthday party, a live event. We're going to record a live bonus podcast. We have five pairs of tickets for listeners to give away. In order to try to get some of those tickets, which we will draw out of the digital hat in some way. Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk, put event in the subject line, and basically just tell us about, you know, when you first started listening to the podcast, how you like to listen to the podcast, that kind of thing. Send us a little message in there about that. We're also, for our 10th anniversary, doing question of the week. We do not have a question to answer this week. We will be starting that from next week. I'm not going to give you the reasons behind that, but suffice it to say, we don't have a question to answer this week. Not because we don't have any questions, so it's not your fault, listeners. It's our fault, right? Okay? Definitely our fault there.
Not you, it's me.
Yeah, it's not you, it's me, definitely. Anyway, question of the week, we want you to send us your question. Money related, we will try to answer it. And the person who gets their question answered each week will get a special limited edition 10th anniversary of the This Is Money podcast mug. And who doesn't love a mug? Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk with question in the subject line, and we will pick one. We will answer it each week. And do not worry if you have already sent us a question, okay? Your questions are entered. Just because we are slackers does not mean that we are going to get all your questions. You have sent us a question already. Don't worry. We've got it. We've got some great questions, just to say, really good questions. Keep them coming, and there will be a question a week and a mug a week. And we might even use the questions to, like, just do some stories on This Is Money as well.
Exactly, why not? This reminds me of a comment I got from someone who said they're a big fan. They were like, it sounds kind of chaotic, but it works. I thought, yeah, I'll take that. Right, that is it. That is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, any specific questions for the team, if you would like to come along to the event, that's all separate. I don't know. I can't even remember what we're doing anymore. Anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
Yeah, for the stuff that Georgie just mentioned, listen to what I just said. Or email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And I don't know why anyone would think this is a bit chaotic sometimes.
It's just honestly slick, my friend, slick. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.